Hello and welcome to the Do One Better podcast in philanthropy, sustainability, and social entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Alberto Aligi from London. Please click that subscribe button and follow us if you're not already doing so, and do leave us a rating and a review. It helps others to find this show as well. Today, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome onto the show Iqbal Dhaliwal, the Global Executive Director of J-PAL, and Vikrant Bhargav, the founder of the Vedas Foundation. Today, we're going to be talking about following the evidence trail for systemic change. And Iqbal and Vikrant are going to be shedding light on the work of J-PAL and the Vedas Foundation, respectively. And also interesting questions such as, how does a philanthropist decide what to fund, where to fund, how to fund, and why evidence is so important in driving forward policy change, and why policy itself should be a key focus within the philanthropic space. So without further ado, Iqbal, Vikrant, a big heartfelt welcome onto the Do One Better podcast today. It's great to see you again.
Thank you,
Albert. An absolute delight.
Excellent. Well, it's great to have both of you on the show. I think we got a little bit of time difference. Iqbal, you're out there in Washington, D.C. today. Vikrant, you're here in the U.K. So wonderful to have you both on the show. Iqbal, you're the Global Executive Director of J-PAL. And Vikrant, you're the founder of the Vedas Foundation, also a family office. And I'd love to find out a little bit more about your respective organizations. And perhaps we can start with J-PAL, a name that I think many of our listeners would be familiar with.
Yes, thanks, Alberto. Happy to go first. So J-PAL is a center that was founded at MIT's economics department 20 years ago, actually, by Abhijit Banerjee, Esther Duflo, and Senthil Mulanathan. And has now grown to be a global anti-poverty organization. And our premise is very simple. Let's use scientific and rigorous evidence to try and find out what works or not in the fight against poverty and climate change. And by poverty, we define it very widely. It's how do you get kids into school? How do you get doctors to show up at work? How do you make sure that farmers are using the most productive seeds? How do you make sure that the energy transition to clean energy is happening correctly? So it's a very widely defined measure of poverty. And we do this using a methodology called randomized evaluations. The premise being that the same rigor that is applied to designing and testing new medicines before they ever reach us, that same rigor of can be applied to social programs and policies in the field before we invest so much of our time, effort, and money into programs that may or may not work. So that's how we started and very soon realized that research alone is not enough, even though it's wonderful. And so now we do a lot more to connect the dots between research and policy.
Excellent. And you didn't mention a specific prize that was given to some of those folks. Don't be so modest. Give us a little bit of a flavor of that as well.
Oh, yes, that was a fun moment. So Abhijit, Esther, and there's one of our third affiliates, Michael Kremer, who's a professor at Chicago, in 2019 won the Nobel Prize in Economics. In fact, what's even more fun about that moment is that I was in London. I had landed in London to meet, guess who? Vikrant Bhargava, who is our second guest here. And I was driving in those famous London taxis back from the airport to the hotel to freshen up to meet Vikrant in 2 hours. When I got the message, and then I was calling and screaming with Abhijit and Esther and others. and that same, and Michael Kremer was actually in London because he was in London that evening. And so I got to see Michael that evening, but I remember Vikrant, that was quite a fun lunch. We were, I was like, okay, we've got to meet, I'm still here. But at the same time, on calls with my team as to how do we message this and all that. I don't know, Vikrant, if you remember that day or not.
You were on cloud nine, obviously with a whole bunch of calls. And I think what made it even more interesting was my office shared a wall with the son of the initial backer of J-PAL. So it was Mr. Latif's son, Hassan, who who used to be sort of Hassan used to spend some time in London, and Hassan's house and my office shared a common wall. So we met up there and then ended up going for lunch. It was yeah, a bunch of coincidences, but I remember that day.
Excellent. And Vikrant, tell me about the Veris Foundation, the family office. I've had your chief executive on the show before. And also I've had the chief executive from the community, Jamil, involved in backing J-PAL. So give us a little bit of a flavor to add to everything.
Fantastic. So I set up my family office quite a few years ago. So I was fortunate to have had a large exit in 2005, 2006. I set up the family office then. And so the family office sort of invests, as you'd expect, across a bunch of asset classes. But I was very keen to do something at scale in the social sector. So even sort of before I went to business school, I had considered joining a development-focused institute. At that point in time, I chose to go to business school. So fortunately, sort of did well in business early on, and then I started to spend a lot more time and effort on sort of call it doing good at scale. But so I set up the foundation many years ago. The foundation, basically, it's all been entirely funded by myself. So we actually haven't had any sort of, we don't raise money from anybody. The first thing we did was to help build a technology platform to allow charities in India to raise money from retail donors. Again, talking of leverage, so my $2.5-3 million investment, but a period of time, a sort of few years to build that and scale up, today powers a platform that's now under Give India. It raises $100+ million on a sustained basis from a bunch of retail donors for lots of charities. But that's what I'd say, sort of a contribution to retail fundraising. At the same time, and I'd written a paper in 2008 with a very dear friend of mine on how we could have the maximum impact if I was giving. And I've been sort of fortunate to be totally cause agnostic, because thankfully, there hasn't been any trauma. A lot of people, giving is dictated by trauma disasters around them. So I've been fortunate to not have had that. And therefore, it's all been about trying to maximize impact. So the other thing was giving at a larger level to try and have the maximal impact. So what I'd call the wholesale giving side. And there it's been a journey, starting in 2012-13, by funding a lot of organizations with small checks. Today, the foundation actually writes very few checks a year. The check sizes are a significant multiple of what they used to be when we would write checks in 2013-14. And it's a lot more narrowly focused in terms of the sort of organizations we support. So today, the foundation's focus is on supporting principally policymakers and people who implement policy to either improve the quality of policy formulation or execution. And I think the theory of change is if you can help improve the efficacy of sort of government spending, even marginally, the impact you can have with that is way higher than anything one can do with themselves. So I'm sorry, long answer to your short question, but the foundation today focuses on, I'd say, it's cause agnostic and maximizing the impact we can do with the giving we have on a yearly basis by helping work with policy formulators, which are the bureaucrats. And that's principally in India. So a lot of the work is focused on India. Outside of that, I also chair an organization called Founders Pledge, which works with a number of entrepreneurs with its members, to help them maximize the good they can do with their giving. By first getting them to pledge a portion of their exit proceeds to giving to good causes, and then equally importantly, helping them maximize the impact with their giving.
I love it. Now, you're both here joining me on the Do One Better podcast, and part of the reason why you're both here at the same time is because you have this partnership, Aspire Partnership. Iqbal, what's the Aspire Partnership all about?
So very much in line with what Vikrant mentioned about, you know, his desire to work with policymakers and governments to make a bigger impact. When J-PAL has also, over its journey, realized that governments are a huge partner in the development arena, and you cannot bypass them, and you should not bypass them. And we had started working with governments on how to incorporate evidence into their decision making a while ago. But it's also a field which takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort because governments change, priorities change. You've got to keep at it to make a difference. Unlike when you work with the nonprofits or the private sector, where there's only one or two key stakeholders, like the CEO or the chief development person, and you convince them, and kind of it gets done. And so we were looking for finding resources to do this because of the sustained effort that it requires. When we got in touch with Vikrant and realized that both of us were thinking very much on the same lines. And that's when Aspire was born. And what Aspire basically tries to do is, you can call it the last mile problem in the evidence or the research journey, which is that there is a significant and growing body of evidence now on what works or not, but very little of it gets incorporated into actual policy. And so it tries to understand what is the reason that it doesn't happen. And part of the reason is that you need people to translate that evidence. You need people to then work with the government, embedded with the government, to make sure that the model gets scaled up with fidelity. And so what Aspire does is exactly that. It helps build a permanent core of team members in India at J-PAL, who then build partnerships with a select number of partners. And most of the time we work with state governments because that is where the action is. And what these partnerships then do is basically begin with a mapping of what the key priorities of the government are, and therefore the citizens are, and map it to the existing evidence on what works or not, understand is it generalizable and applicable to the local context. And if the answer to that is yes, then it goes through a series of things, including looking and seeing what is the local administrative data that is available that can help us. Who are the right people to bring into the mix to advise the government? Is it a researcher? Is it senior staff from J-PAL? And then work with the government throughout that entire process of taking that small little program and hoping that it reaches scale and affects millions of people. So that's the underpinning of Aspire.
If I may just add to that. So I think it'd be helpful. So Aspire stands for Alliance for Scaling Policy Impact through Research and Evidence. So as the name suggests, it is to scale that. J-PAL's done lots of RCTs. So there's a huge body of evidence that's been generated on things that work. I always call Aspire more the commercialization arm. If you think of J-PAL being sort of the IP creation arm. So in a university, there is IP creation and commercialization that happens. Think of Aspire as a scaling up and the commercialization, not for profit, but it's a commercialization, but scaling up of the IP that J-PAL's researchers have created over the last number of years.
Got it. Now, to those folks listening, many of whom are philanthropists or CEOs of foundations, policymakers as well, what you're talking about is music to their ears. You know, scaling impact, having evidence base to underpin your decisions, all of this is exactly what people want. And so let me ask you both, in no particular order, what or how should a philanthropist decide where to fund, what to fund? These are questions that I hear a lot. And oftentimes, you know, people have a bag of money in their endowments, and it's not that easy to figure out the deal flow, as it were, of what you're going to back. It's more difficult than many people think. What are the words of wisdom based on your expertise and your experience in terms of what to fund, where to fund?
When I started the journey, I did not know what to fund or where to fund. And I think that's a great place to start from. Most philanthropists actually come to the table knowing what they will fund, knowing how the problem's going to be solved, and then they go out backing people saying, hey, this is what you do. So I think that is where the big problem lies, when smart people made money, believe that they know how to solve the world's big problems, and then they will go at those problems with a very clear way of how they're going to solve it. And often it's quite narrow. And I think that often leads to behaviors that actually doesn't really solve the problem, creates that'll often create more problems. So if one goes to looking at a problem as opposed to the method of solving the problem. I think that's really important. So I'd always say, keep your eyes on the problem and look for the best solution to the problem. Do not start off by believing that you know you have a solution to a problem. I think that's step one. So you're not that smart at solving sort of development problems if you made your money through business and so on. So I think go there saying, yeah, I'd like to help solve this problem. Often the solution to that problem may be by solving some other problem, which will also take care of this. You don't have to sort of restrict it to something very narrow. You may want to solve sanitation. You could solve it by having sort of economic development will often end up solving a whole bunch of problems. It may create a few other problems, but it solves a lot of problems that a lot of people spend their time and energy on. So that's a good area to focus on if one's just focused on that. But otherwise, right, I'll repeat myself, which is not to go in knowing the solution to a problem.
Right. Iqbal, I'm not sure whether you have a bunch of people throwing a bunch of money your way or not, but you certainly deal with a lot of philanthropists and people with resources. What's your take on things? What do you encourage them to think about when they think about what, where, how?
So I think I would tell them to be more like Vikrant, exactly like he described. I think which is to you know, I think it's good to have a goal in mind. A broad set of goals are completely fine, which is, you know, it could be as simple as what you described. I want to make difference at scale. Or it could be something like, I want to make a difference in climate change, or I want to do something for girls' empowerment. It's completely fine to start with that. But what I discourage people is to say, I want to build toilets for girls in primary schools, because I think that is the way for us to empower the girls. And the reason the girls are probably not coming to school is because there are no toilets in the school. So, you know, that's the point at which I start getting a little nervous and start asking them, you know, what exactly is that you're trying to do? Are you interested in the best ways to get girls to come to school? Are you interested in the best ways that girls, having come to school, learn better? Are you interested in the making sure that they graduate? Are you interested in the dignity of the girls? Are you interested in their safety? And oftentimes the answer will be all of the above. And I would be like, you know, there are very few programs in the world that can do all of the above. So you've got to prioritize a little bit about which one of these you want them to do. And having done that, go in with an open mind, look at a series of options or solutions that might drive you to that. And we can work with you to narrow it down. You know, the world is awash in data now. A lot of it is administrative data that is sitting with governments. And just basic analysis of that administrative data can give you a host of information. Even simple correlations can help you narrow down your hypothesis. And once you narrow your hypothesis down to two or three reasonable hypotheses, you know, or solutions which might work for that context, then test them and test them rigorously to see how they're working. And once you are convinced that something works, then of course go all in while making sure that you're measuring your outcomes and the good things. And so I think that simple strategy oftentimes is very hard for people to follow. You know, you would think that this is what's so rocket science-y about what I just described. But there is such a desire to, you know, I already know the solution, time is ticking, the world cannot wait, people are, you know, dying. Yes, all of that is true. But, you know, if we had done this right 70, 80 years ago, then far fewer people would be suffering today. But because we didn't get it right 70, 80 years ago, and 70, 80 years ago, people were very confident about the solutions as well. But clearly, many of them didn't work out. We just need to take a little bit of pause, and go down a slightly windy path, but knowing then that the results down the line are going to be far more impactful.
Mm. When you say about doing it right and the evidence and making sure that you're relying on evidence, is all the evidence equally as good? And obviously, it's perhaps a little bit unfair. I'm asking somebody who's based at MIT, you know, you have incredible credentials, but any words of wisdom when people are saying, oh, we're evidence-based? Well, yes, but
Yes, great question, Alberto, and what basically underpins the Nobel Prize itself that you asked me about earlier. I think people have had different interpretations, exactly as you said, about what evidence means. When I was long time ago working in the Indian civil service, you would get these delegates either from the central government or sometimes from the World Bank who would come, and we would arrange visits for them in the villages to go see some of the projects in place. And they would literally call, you know, go down there, helicopter there for a couple of hours and walk around, or, you know, people would have around, you know, assembled a team of local village people, and they would say, hey, we introduced program X, how is it going? And people would say, yes, sir, it's all going well, but little bit improvement here and there. And they would, everybody would kind of go back happy with this glow that, oh, we talked to seven people and those seven people were very pleased. And so I think we started from these anecdotes and these literally stories being defined as evidence. Then we moved to before and after analysis. And then in all of this, I think the one question, Alberto, you have to ask is, what is the counterfactual? And the counterfactual is very simply saying, if I had not introduced the program, what would the lives of these people have turned out like? And that, to if you really want to get to the causality, you then have to measure the counterfactual. And obviously the counterfactual is hard to measure because it never happened. You introduced the program for some people. And so I think randomized evaluations that we focus on try to get to that causality in a very rigorous way. You know, there were decades and decades of debate about whether this is the right way to do it. And I think, again, that prize that you told me about settled that issue to a large extent.
When we're looking at philanthropy, it might at first sight seem like, wow, it's a huge field, huge budgets, but in actual fact, relative to government, very, very small. Is it, and perhaps you're both biased here, I'm not sure, but is it a question genuinely, look, you want to make a difference, you're going to have to engage policymakers, and you're going to have to engage them in a way that's, you're articulating the evidence well, and genuinely you're trying to drive a change in policy. Is that a fair assessment, fair characterization of things?
I think this is a biased set. We're both in that camp where we believe that if you can help the government, yeah, the impact is high, but I would say that an overwhelming majority of philanthropists will actually work outside of the government and not with the government. There are very few that actually work with policymakers. It's not easy, and I think Iqbal can add to that. It's much easier to raise money if you are setting up a new hospital, new school, new whatever, much easier than if you were to be raising money to help fix the public education system or the public health system, because you can't put your name up on those buildings and so on. So a bunch of reasons, but typically your starting point is, hey, the government's done its job badly, therefore we have to go fix it. But then it's not fix it. People end up sort of building a new one as opposed to fixing what the government's anyway spending a fair amount of time. And the government will keep spending money, maybe if efficiently, inefficiently, whatever, but it's a much larger amount of money. So in India, I mean, the government spends 30 times what the not-for-profit sector collectively does. So if you're able to make a minuscule difference to how sort of the government spending actually gets done, it's likely to be far more impactful than any of the sort of private not-for-profit organizations would manage to do on their own.
Yeah. Now, you both have experience dealing with policymakers, with government officials. Question for you, how open are, say, an education minister to listen to the evidence of a philanthropist? I mean, do they have enough bandwidth? Or is it the case that, look, I'm one person, I'm the education minister, and I have like 100 different foundations, all of them with their RCTs, all of them with their policy initiatives, I'm going to lose my mind. Can I listen to all of them? Can I engage to all of them? Tell me a little bit about that dynamic and how easy or challenging is it genuinely to engage with a policymaker? Iqbal?
This is one of the things which I have been surprised over the years of how receptive actually people are to listen to you. I think people will give you the first here. The second meeting is up to you as to what you did in the first meeting. But I think people are generally receptive. And the first reason for that is what Vikrant said earlier. It's not as if people are lining up a lot to work with governments, especially on the philanthropy side or on the academic side. I think there are a lot of vendors who are lining up to work with government, lots of consultants who are lining up to work with governments on paid contracts. There are lots of, you know, so-called NGOs who get contracts from the government to implement programs in the field. And India has thousands and thousands of them who are lining up. But there are very few people like Vikrant who are knocking at the government's door. I would say, you know, the pioneer in this field has been the Gates Foundation 30 years ago, who said, rather than trying to duplicate our efforts, we will work with governments. So folks like Bill Gates, folks like Vikrant are relatively rare who are willing to say, I'm not going to create a whole independent network of NGOs delivering books into their houses. Instead, I'm going to find and see how schools, government schools, can get better at finding the right tools and inputs to help them. And so that's part one. And then similarly, Alberto, on the academic side, I think there are very few academic institutions which go to governments and say, look, we are not here to sign a contract with you. We don't need any money from you. We are sitting on exactly what Vikrant earlier called the IP. We are sitting on a lot of knowledge. And as our mission of our public service mission, we are here to help, assist, and do it in any way possible. And then the final thing I would say is that you're absolutely right. The education minister has 100 things to do. And the problem is that, unfortunately, about 95 of them are completely arcane. You know, dealing with the unions and, you know, what should be the hours and how should the textbooks be redesigned? What should be the school uniform? Which school building should be built or not built? The mind space left for thinking about innovation, thinking about problems strategically is very little. And I think, you know, philanthropy and evidence-based organizations like JPAL, folks like us fill that space. But then the second part, and this comes to meeting number two. So that's why I think we get meeting number one. Meeting number two you get when you are willing to be in it for the long run. I'm not here just to tell you about one project and then, you know, my success is that you scaled up that one project and I'm gone. But to say that, look, I'm going to be here with you in the long run as a partner. Today it might be education, tomorrow it might be climate change. Within climate change today, it might be mitigation and emissions trading, but tomorrow it might be something completely different on adaptation. And I think that's the vision of Aspire, that we aspires to be the long-term partner for a lot of policymakers on their entire gamut of needs versus we are in and out. But Vikram, you might have something to add to that.
So Iqbal, you were part of the Indian bureaucracy many years ago. And I think the Indian bureaucracy has a lot of very good, bright people like Iqbal who go in wanting to do good. And unfortunately, what happens is you've got the bureaucracy at the very top, made up of IAS officers who are all super smart, create a very tough exam to make it. But then below them, there aren't that many very capable people available to them to help them in their work. When we deal with policy makers, we don't deal with politicians. We deal with the bureaucracy. We deal with officers. And even if it's a small minority of officers who are ultra committed to their work and super bright, so let's say 15-20%, if we are able to just target that 15-20% and work with them on their journey, and they will get transferred from one department to another every few years, we can stay with them, go across departments, helping them fix departments during their tenures. And it's like providing an excellent team. Often it's like a team of super smart analysts to a person with a very large checkbook, with a ridiculous amount of power, and just giving them the right data in a timely manner, in a usable manner, with which that person can sort of actually make long-lasting policy changes. So that's how we see what we do. So we work more with the bureaucrats, less with politicians. So actually, I've met very few politicians. But I met a lot of bureaucrats, and every meeting I've had with bureaucrats, I'd say most meetings I've had with senior officials, I have been surprised positively.
And now, in terms of the innovative thinking, the strategic thinking, Iqbal, a few minutes ago, you referenced the emissions trading. And I know when the three of us were having a chat a few weeks back, maybe a few months back, this emissions trading scheme that you have as part of Aspire, that partnership, would love to find out a little bit about that, because I think it's fascinating.
So Alberto, I think you and the emissions trading scheme is one of the most exciting things that J-PAL is involved in, and I hope also is the case for Aspire. So a few years ago, one of our research affiliates, Michael Greenstone, he was working with the Obama White House about what you would remember used to be this whole model for carbon trading. And the hope was that this is a way that the industry can reduce its emissions of carbon, but do it in a market-based solution. And that didn't go too far because of mostly political bickering rather than solid economic reasons. And so we, at some point, Michael and J-PAL, we said, what are the other places in the world which could benefit from something similar? And J-PAL had a long-standing partnership with the government of Gujarat, which was started when the current Prime Minister, Mr. Narendra Modi, was the chief minister. And so we had signed an MOU and started working with the government at that time and done a bunch of works with the Environment Department. And so we approached the Energy and Environment Department in Gujarat and asked them that would they be interested in a similar model based around emissions. And the current model is very much like it is in most LMICs, which is around command and control. And what I mean by that is that you set an emission standard and say that every industry is permitted to emit up to X level. And if they emit more than X, then you are going to be fined a lot. And so that's the command. And the way the control works is you have this army of auditors who are supposed to randomly go to various locations, inspect them, and if they find that the emissions are are more than the threshold, then they would fine them. And as you can imagine, this is subject to a whole lot of inefficiencies, but also spawns a whole level of corruption, because there are then incentives to cheat the system and get away with it by not doing the right things. And so in a sense, the market can solve this problem and technology can help by installing on the various chimneys and the smokestack small sensors which can report in real time, thanks to technological improvements, what each industry is emitting. So you don't need to send auditors to go and check and sample the air at a particular point of time. You are now getting real-time data. But what that real-time data also does is it allows, instead of just fining these industries, to just set up a system where you can trade these credits, these emission credits. And so what that means is if I'm emitting more than what I'm allowed to, I can buy a credit from you, Alberto, who's emitting less than you are allowed to. And so in a sense, the market clears and sets the fine in a sense by setting this price. So when we did this trial in the city of Surat in Gujarat, we essentially found that the emission trading leads to a decline in emissions because the industry really embraces it. And not only does the market set a clear price for the emission, but it induces the factories which have to buy the credits to actually install the various equipment which would lead to a reduction in their own emissions as well. And so now we are working with the government of Gujarat with support from Aspire to scale this up in the city of Ahmedabad, which is the capital of Gujarat. In fact, I was there just a few months ago along with Vikrant's team, and the government announced a massive scale up in the city of Ahmedabad. So very excited to see how this model works in Gujarat, because the scalability, it can have it's a very easy model to scale in theory across different states in India. India, as you know, is grappling with a huge problem of pollution as well as carbon being emitted in the air. And in a sense, this can solve both the problem, help in the mitigation and also help in pollution. So very, very excited about this.
Absolutely fascinating. Vikrant, with your business hat on, how do you see this as potential for improving incentives and the environment and the market?
So I think one, you have to look at, is this a climate initiative? Is this a health intervention? It actually meets sort of multiple criteria at the same time. What the study found was industries had to invest less than they otherwise would have had to have a greater impact, greater reduction in pollution levels, which again, so from an ROI perspective, is much better than what used to be the case historically. So it makes business sense, it's good for the world, it's better for health, makes absolute sense to do so. So yeah, I mean, we're very pleased to have sort of supported JPL through Aspire on doing this and hope to see this roll out to more cities across more states.
Absolutely. And now as we're coming to the end of our chat today, a few things I want to ask you. One, what's the most fun and perhaps also the most surprising aspect of each of your work? So that would be great to ask each one of you. And then also a key takeaway, you know, in terms of what you'd love for the audience to keep in mind after they finish listening to today. So I don't know, perhaps Vikrant, we start with you.
So the most surprising, I'm going to go with that one first, is me talking about working with a GERB. So if 10 years ago you had asked me who you'd be working with, and even if I'd come up with 15 sort of options, the government would not have been one of those. So to me, the very fact that today the foundation is sort of entirely focused on working with the government has been a huge surprise for me, but it's not a shock because, as I said, I never go into anything with any priors. I always like to believe that I am an expert at nothing. I use data and evidence to make my decisions. And in this case, our thinking's evolved. And today it is all about working with the government to try and maximize impact. So that hasn't changed. Wanting to have impact at sort of scale has not changed. And that's so working with the government has been the surprising thing. I think fun bit's just been meeting the very wide sort of breadth of people I've met over the course of the last many years across all spectrums. So I've learned a lot from there's one lady who had cleared her eighth grade and in a meeting, some of the things she said, I wouldn't have come up with those on my own. And now that it guides me in how I think. So it was all about sort of government schools versus private schools. She was convincing in why the government schools are actually a lot better than sending your kids to private schools in the rural areas. The government schools have teachers who are properly trained, they pay better, etc. The problem is the teachers don't show up. So if you're able to make sure that the teachers are there and the infrastructure is there, the level of education that a child is going to get in a government school is likely to be a lot better than they would get in a private school, even though the teachers show up and the building may be there because the teachers themselves are actually very poor quality. So coming back to the fun bit, it's just meeting the large number of people I have over the last many years. It's been very fulfilling.
And that key takeaway?
Do not fall for stories. Believe in numbers. Use your brain. So I often say use your brain more than your heart. So when you're making a decision on who to give to, what to give to, use your head. Quantum of how much you're giving, use your heart. It shouldn't be the other way around.
Iqbal, on your side, most fun, most surprising, key takeaway?
I'm going to follow the same order as Vikrant. I think the most surprising thing for me is that I've been doing this for 15 years and still not bored. As Vikrant was saying earlier, civil servants get transferred a lot. So when I joined the civil service, I was not expecting to be doing the same thing for more than 2 years. And so I'm surprised at that. I just completed 15 years here. And I think the reason for that is your second question about the fun bit. I think it has been a hugely fun journey. Part of the reason is exactly what Vikrant said. I've got an opportunity to work with governments, philanthropists, really bright researchers, you know, the program participants who have been so generous with their time. You know, if you had told me, would people in rural Ghana or in rural Peru be willing to sit for 5 hours and answer your questions, I would be like, wow, they have better things to do in life. But no, they have been so generous with their time, working with universities, with young academics. It's been a really, really fun journey. And I think what has also made it fun is to see the impact of your work and to see it, you know, making a difference in the lives of people. Last year, we did this a little bit of bean counting at our 20th year anniversary, and we did it very conservatively. And more than 600 million people have been reached by programs that we evaluated, found that they were effective and that were then scaled up. And so it's been really, really fun for that reason. In terms of a key takeaway, I think it's based not just at my life here at J-PAL, but previously in the government, starting my life in development economics, that I think we spend way too much time looking for silver bullets. If you remember, Alberto, you and I have enough gray hair to remember this. You know, there was a time when community participation was supposed to solve our problem. Basically, the best way to improve the learning outcome was to involve the parents in the education of the children and for them to have parent-teacher meetings. Little did we realize, it was finally experiments which showed us that, look, you know, the parents have no agency over a teacher. The parents are not gone to school. The teachers are like graduates from college. Oftentimes, the parents are from very low socioeconomic backgrounds, sometimes from tribes or castes which are marginalized. The teacher happens to be a Brahmin or happens to be an upper caste person, very much more socioeconomic. Community participation doesn't work unless you create it. Then it became microfinance was going to solve all our problems. We were going to make everybody an entrepreneur. And then that didn't go well. And there was a time when technology meant let's get one laptop in the hand of every child and somehow the children will learn and, you know, they will get access. So this field of development is littered with these search for silver bullets and failed silver bullets, when in fact, there are so many of these solutions, which may not be a silver bullet solutions, but which are tested, which are evaluated, and which are found to work. How do you get kids to come to school can often be a very different question from once the kids are in school, how do you improve their learning outcomes? Which can then be a very different question that even if the kid has come to school, learned well, will they be matched to the right job or not? So there is no silver bullet. You've got to answer question one sometimes separately from question two separately and question three separately. And I'd just like to say to anybody who's listening that we are now in a very good position of knowing the answer to these questions, to many of the these questions. And so rather than search for these elusive silver bullets, it's much harder, it's much less sexy, but if we can get this right, then I think we can actually make a big difference in the lives of people in real time rather than waiting for the next silver bullet.
Wonderful. And on that note of wisdom, thank you both so very much, Iqbal, Vikrant. It's been an absolute pleasure hosting both of you on the Do One Better podcast, and I'm already looking forward to our next conversation.
Thanks, Alberto. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you very much, Alberto. It's been a pleasure.
Perfect, and that's a wrap. Thanks so much for tuning in. As always, you've been listening to a fascinating conversation with Iqbal Dhaliwal, the Global Executive Director of J-PAL, and Vikrant Vargav, the founder of the Vedis Foundation. For information about this conversation and more than 250 other interviews and case studies with remarkable thought leaders in philanthropy, sustainability, and social entrepreneurship, just visit our website at lidji.org. That's lidji.org. Please click that subscribe button and follow us if you're not already doing so, and do leave us a rating and a review. It helps others to find the show as well. Thoroughly enjoy producing today's show for you, and I'll catch you this coming Monday.